you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. Kevin Barrett back on the show. He returns to discuss some recent articles he has posted regarding the COVID-19 panic and maybe some of the agendas behind this event, I think, as we should see this as it unfolds. Of course, Dr. Barrett has taught at colleges and universities in San Francisco, Paris, and Wisconsin. He is also the host of Truth Jihad Radio and the co-host of False Flag Weekly. Correct? You're still a co-host of that, right?
Yeah, False Flag Weekly News.
News, okay.
Yeah, we cover the week's most interesting 30 news stories.
Do you, is that, you know, now you do it routinely with E. Michael Jones now?
You know, he's getting to be pretty regular on the show. Yeah. Yeah, we've gone through all kinds of rotations, but yeah, I love doing it with Mike. He's a lot of fun.
Yeah, you two are good, you know, you being him the Catholic, you the Muslim, and you talk about these things. It's an interesting interaction between you two. Of course, you also you translated Laurent Guyon's. That's how you Guyon, right?
How you pronounce the name? Guyon.
Guyon. Okay, French isn't that good. His book From Yahweh to Zion: Jealous God, Chosen People, Promised Land, Class of Civilization. Okay. Anything else you want to add to that, or?
Well, I've written a bunch of books, but I don't have any books out since, I guess, 2016. Okay. I had a false flag trilogy there about that rash of false flags around the Charlie Hebdo era.
Oh, yes, right. Remember, that seems so long ago now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a whole new panic now, isn't it?
But I think it's related because it's all about the panic, fear, hysteria that they use to control people. Whatever reality there is to this so-called pandemic, it's clear that there are agendas that are being pursued or advanced by it. Be them, you know, cultural or social, technocratic, economic, even geopolitical, which I think they all kind of meld together. And you've penned some recent articles about this, posted them, 9/11 truth, coronavirus truth, Zionist hysteria. You also talk about some of the economic agenda behind it and also geopolitical. So I'll let you take it from there.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe I could start by making that connection with the Charlie Hebdo event. One of the most interesting books I ever put out is called We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, and it features a bunch of leading intellectuals pushing back against the Charlie Hebdo orthodoxy of the time. And, you know, it included some fairly mainstream figures. Rabbi Michael Lerner contributed an article to that book, and there are a number of others. I think John Cobb was in there. He's the world's leading Protestant theologian, or at least the most accomplished, in my view. And so there were a lot of fairly mainstream people, as well as the usual red pill suspects, folks like me. And we looked at Charlie Hebdo as a case where this kind of fake idealism and people's good instincts was being abused by a false flag event. And I think there's a parallel with the corona crisis, because likewise, just like in Charlie Hebdo, they've managed to get all the right-thinking people on the same page. Like when they had that, you know, million people rallying in France, all holding identical signs saying, "We are Charlie," there was something kind of suspicious about that. It happened just a day or two after the ostensible terror event, and everybody was carrying exactly the same sign. And they were all very well-meaning. They're all thinking that they were standing up against, barbaric slaughter of cartoonists. And they were standing for free speech and openness and tolerance and pluralism and goodness, right? And likewise, with this corona crisis, they've got people all putting on masks and social distancing and being willing to lose their jobs and their futures and the whole economy and starve 250 million people around the planet, all for doing a really good idealistic thing, for protecting the vulnerable people from this terrible corona plague. And so just like with Charlie Hebdo, you have people's idealism and their wanting to do good for other people being misused and hijacked by people with an agenda. And I think that in both cases, we have to go all the way and take the complete red pill and admit that these events are not what they seemed. They're staged and orchestrated. They were made to happen. In other words, Charlie Hebdo, just like 9/11, was not a radical Muslim terror attack. There probably was a real massacre. I'm not one of these people who says, they never ever actually kill anybody. It's all fake. I think probably there were people killed at Charlie Hebdo, but it was a staged professional killing. It wasn't just random radical Muslims angry at cartoonists. It was designed by the high-level people in intelligence services, probably linked to Israel, just like 9/11, designed to get a political effect going. And likewise with the corona crisis, I don't think this virus just randomly happened to mutate and hop from a bat, into a bowl of bat soup and then into the throat of somebody eating bat soup in a Wuhan market. Nor do I think it just randomly happened to escape from a lab such as the Wuhan Biolab, or maybe in North Carolina where they were working on this type of thing, or Fort Detrick where they had a huge problem in the summer of 2019. So I think this was deliberate. I think this has been deliberately spread in order to create the effects that we're seeing, just like the Charlie Hebdo incident was deliberately orchestrated to get those effects. And in both cases, they've managed to get the most liberal, educated or miseducated, idealistic people all believing that they're doing something really good by acting robotically in herd fashion, like the proverbial sheeple, all carrying the same "we are not, we are Charlie" sign, and all kind of, putting on the face masks, doing the social distancing, and scowling at the, unwashed masses who don't believe this. And, and this is where it's gotten interesting. In 2016, the people who were suspicious of the Charlie Hebdo event were by and large right across, representative cross-section of the political spectrum. It wasn't really more left than right or anything like that. There were people who thought of themselves as sort of defending the working class. And then there were people from the libertarians defending the right to make as much money as you want. There were all sorts of different people. It was more just, who was red-pilled, who wasn't, who saw through 9/11, who didn't. That would be the predictor of whether you saw through Charlie Hebdo. But now, with the corona crisis, it's become this partisan thing where the Republicans and the working class, that's a weird marriage, to say the least, are the people that are tending to see through it. And the sort of the liberals and the managerial class and the more educated and the more affluent are the people who are going along with the party line and falling for the hoax. So, and by the way, I don't say it's a hoax in that there's no virus. No, I think it's a hoax in that they're telling us that this is just a natural virus when they're the ones who did it to us. The people who wanted the lockdown wanted to do it. So maybe, from here we could go on and talk a little bit about, who did it and why they would want to do it.
Yeah. It's an interesting observation. So this appeal to emotion, sort of this almost choreographed response that you see, like Charlie Hebdo, all of a sudden almost overnight, you have millions of signs printed up and distributed. And this we're seeing similar things occur with the COVID-19 pandemic and how, all the stores all of a sudden have all these pre-printed signs and they're set up to do this stuff. And you also have, this sort of choreographed, where you call it, are the people working in hospitals are they're heroes, and people working at grocery stores are heroes, and some reason police are heroes, and we're told that was it. There's timed where people come out and they clap for them or something in some countries at a certain time, and so it all sort of choreographed. But so the appeal to emotion is interesting. The Christian create the fear, then the emotion, sort of the sentimental stuff, the first responder terminology that we saw developed about 18 years ago. Now we have nurses are heroes, doctors are heroes, even grocery store workers are heroes. It's a strange thing. But
So people are standing in line, to check out their groceries, and they start, spontaneously applauding the guy who's, running the cash register. It's pretty weird.
It's bizarre, yeah. And of course there's the so-called science behind the measures, whether it's social distancing or mask wearing, is dare I say dubious, to say the least. I mean, it's just arbitrary. You can infer all types of social engineering, psychological strategies for trying promoting that thing, social atomization, fear of people. Of course, if you have to maintain social distance, you certainly can organize and politically against this. At least it's much more difficult. Like, how do you organize a recall petition for like the tyrannical governor of California or the mayor of Los Angeles, if you can't get petitions signed? It's very simple how they shut down all political opposition at the same time under the guise of public health. That's very convenient. The agendas, in your article about 9/11, you talk about how the timing, of course, we have the Project for the New American Century talking about the newer Pearl Harbor, how we need a galvanizing, transformative event. Of course, we get it with 9/11. And this pulled it saved a lot of people, like whether it's Israel, what was going on with the economy, with the tech boom was busting and all that. And we got a transformative event. And the same thing with 2008. And of course, now we're talking about this crisis, and we're going to merge into the new normal, as they say. Right? It's very similar. So I'll let you expand on that.
Well, yeah, I think that 9/11 was first and foremost, I was going to say first and foremost about foreign policy, about turning the United States military into an enforcement wing of the IDF, basically, and go after Israel's enemies, hijacking U.S. military to smash up the Middle East. That was a big part of it. But there was also another part that may be relevant here, because with the corona thing, we can see that it is being leveraged for war on China. China's being the patsy here, just like the radical Muslims were the patsies for 9/11. Everybody is being rallied to hate on these the Chinese. And interestingly, Trump supporters are falling for that more than the Democrats. So it's actually kind of bizarre how, in one aspect of the hoax, the Democrats are falling for it more than the Republicans. But on this other aspect of the hoax, blaming China, it's the other way around. And so at that level, there's this foreign policy component. But then there's a financial component as well. I recently had Daniel Estulin on my radio show talking about coronavirus as a debt liquidation scam. He pointed out that there were $4 quadrillion in unpayable debt. It was about to bring down the global economy anyway. We've reached the limits to growth for various reasons. And then this debt bubble was going to threaten to cause the same kind of economic havoc, or at least something like what we're seeing anyway with the coronavirus. It was going to happen anyway. There's going to be a huge greatest depression. So this has given them an excuse for their greatest depression and an excuse to hand trillions of dollars in free money to the worst malefactors and criminals, the people who really should all be getting nationalized. So it's a big financial bailout for the biggest financiers. And 9/11 was too. We forget that it wasn't just the Israelis who needed 9/11 to save their economy after the dot-com bust. It was the whole Western bankster structure. And in fact, they started with their massive QE, unprecedented QE, that is printing vast amounts of money in August of 2001 in preparation for the big event. And 9/11, just like this corona crisis, bailed out the system. It bailed out the people who run the system, the people who print our money out of thin air and lend it into existence at interest, creating these unsustainable debt bubbles that have ballooned up to quadrillions, often based on these new kinds of so-called money like derivatives and so on. So the bankster cabal that runs the West and that is dedicated to controlling the entire world and creating a one-world planetary government under their direction is using these events like 9/11 and the Corona crisis, which they're creating in the first place, as ways to both demonize a foreign party and mobilize for the kind of war that they need to conquer and to make their empire bigger and ultimately to make it encompass the whole planet. And then they also are using it to write off their unpayable debt bubbles and to re-engineer their financial game. So I think that's kind of the bottom line of these events. But then we could also add that they need to scale back the Western and especially American tradition of civil liberties, because obviously they're doing this without the consent of the people. And to the extent that ordinary people understand what's really going on, they're horrified and they're not going to go along with it. So the 9/11 and the Corona crisis were also used to scale back civil liberties, of course, to bring in different kinds of population control measures and mind control measures. And so we can see that parallel as well. In that sense, you know, those three, you know, major effects, the financial, the foreign policy, and the totalitarian ending civil liberties aspect, 9/11 and the manufactured Corona crisis are all, you know, very similar. We see that the template was 9/11, and now we see a new version of the same thing.
Yeah, I had a friend over last night. We were just discussing, you know, some of the measures, the control measures, the lockdowns, and sort of the stupidity of it all, the recklessness, the destructive nature of it. And you have to ask why. And I just made the point, you can't take this out of the geopolitical economic context. So that's the bigger picture. And the cover is the pandemic. And that's why it's been overblown into this massive global public health crisis. That's the cover. And the austerity measures that are necessary for this transformation process is being justified under the guise of a pandemic. And naturally, there's going to be resistance to it because not everyone is on board. And when you live in a society like the United States, which is still highly decentralized, and you have a lot of people within the system who think that they are free, and the procedures and constitutional rights and these things do matter, and they're going to fight back. And at the very least, this global elite's going to have a very difficult mopping up operation to do if they're going to see their agenda fulfilled. There is Michael Hudson has, you know, he's written about this economic system, and he's talked about what the world needs right now is sort of a global jubilee at this point with the debt. But you can't have that because that would produce an equitable resolution to this. And they want to maintain their power, get richer, and enslave everybody. That's why they have to pull off these. They can't deal with it honestly with the people, saying, okay, well, this system is not sustainable. The usurious, you know, fractional reserve usurious banking system, debt-based money system, it's ultimately it's self-negating. So you always have these booms and busts because it collapses, and they're just in a position to profit off the bust because they can time the bust perfectly. And that's what you seem to get with 2001 or 2008 or even 1929 and these things. The result is always greater concentration of wealth into the fewer hands, the very hands that created the crisis. But Michael Hudson was in an interview, and he said this about what's just gone down, you know, with the $6 trillion bailout that you referred to. Just think of when the debates with Bernie Sanders during the spring, Biden and Klobuchar kept saying, what we're paying for Medicare for all will be $1 trillion over 10 years. Well, here the Fed can create $1.5 trillion in 1 week just to buy stocks. Why is it okay for the Fed to create $1.5 trillion to buy stocks to prevent rich people from losing on their stocks when it's not okay to print $1 trillion to pay for free Medicare for the entire population? This is crazy. The idea that the only rich should be allowed to print money for themselves, but the government should not be allowed to print money for any public purpose, any social purpose, not for medicine, not for schools, not for personal budgets, not for full employment, but only give it to the 1%. People hesitate to think. They think it can't possibly be this bad, but for those of us who have worked on Wall Street for 60 years, in my case, that's what the numbers show. But you don't have to have the media talk. But you don't have the media talking about the actual numbers. They talk about just words and they use euphemisms. It's kind of Orwellian vocabulary describing an inside-out world. And yeah, so I mean, and that's what we had. We had with this so-called, you know, the CARES Act and this bailing out, and of course this empowers groups like this BlackRock group, which is a Zionist outfit, coincidentally. Larry Fink, I think, runs it. And that's an interesting backstory behind that outfit. I think they made a lot of money off the 2008 crisis. So you have an economic reset. And this is also, you also need the economic reset and the economic calamity to the depression in order to facilitate politically the imposition of the technocratic control measures that people like Bill Gates are so anxious to impose upon us, whether it's forced vaccinations or 24/7, 365 monitoring with our cell phones and contract tracing, even biometric tattoos, which is like chipping. It's just that crazy.
Yeah, that's all. That's absolutely right. And, you know, if they hadn't done this, then as the cascade of bankruptcies happen, as the debt bubble pops, you know, if they kept running it as a free market system, then what would happen would be these big banks and corporations would go bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hence the necessity for the bailout. And as that happened, then either the state would have to take them over and run them as public utilities or bust them up and let smaller entities have the market share. So you would have seen a net transfer of market share to the smaller entities from the bigger entities. And of course, they want to do it the other way around. They want to keep centralizing wealth and power and moving the market share to the biggest entities, ultimately getting pretty much everything controlled by a tiny plutocracy. So to do that, they use these crises, whether 9/11 or the Corona crisis. And we see very clearly today how they are putting the smaller entities out of business for the profit of the bigger entities, and especially the very biggest entities, the giant banks, investment houses that sit on top of the whole system. You know, those guys would have all been out of business pretty soon if it hadn't been for the Corona crisis. But now they've got their excuse to pump those trillions of dollars in bailouts to save those guys. Meanwhile, the little guys on Main Street are out of business. They're forced to stay home. Their customers are forced to stay home. So we're seeing the world's biggest heist, the biggest transfer from the haves, from the have-nots to the haves in the history of the world. And that's precisely what this was designed to do. To centralize power and wealth in the hands of the haves. And the military-industrial complex is making vast piles of money off of this. Sure, Boeing lost some money off their civilian airliner business, but they've more than made up for it in their military business. So they're doing great. Northrop Grumman and the other military contractors likewise are soaring high and doing very, very well now. And they're always going to get bailed out. Whereas all the smaller enterprises, of course, are dead in the water. And this is useful in a lot of ways, not only for the bad guys who would like to centralize planetary governance under their control. It's useful to them to put the smaller entities out of business because those entities actually give the people that run them a certain amount of freedom and the ability to potentially fight back. For instance, you know, an example of this is that after 9/11, once I got involved in the truth movement, which that happened right about the beginning of 2004, I started doing teach-ins at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and having events. And the people who supported the events and hosted the events were the independent local cafe owners. At one point, we had, I think, like three or four out of the five main local cafes in Madison, Wisconsin, hosting 9/11 truth events with the owners donating money to the truth movement and being fully on board with it. Because they were all independent business people, small business people, and they didn't have to answer to anybody. You know, I was working for the university. And ultimately, Steve Nass, this Republican legislator, was able to launch a witch hunt against me and threaten, you know, to withhold funding from the university. And of course, the feds did the same thing, and various Zionist private parties also threatened the University of Wisconsin financially. They lost more than $500,000 in canceled contributions the day after I was on Fox News in, I think it was early July of 2006. So the university is a big operation, and ultimately it's all under the control of the people handing them the money, which is various big money types. And so they then have to crack down and essentially prevent the university professors from seeking the truth about things like 9/11. But if you have these kinds of small businesses that are dominating the economic landscape, run by people who are totally independent and can choose to do whatever they think is right, then something like the 9/11 truth movement is going to be possible. And so today, when they're putting all the small businesses out of business, what they're doing is they're robbing independence and autonomy from the population. And they're making sure that the only people left with any money and any security are the people who are working for, ultimately, the banksters who print the money out of thin air. You know, if you work at the university, like a lot of people I know do, you're the hired intellectual hired gun of the banksters, ultimately. And if you go against them like I did, you'll be punished and perhaps forced out, or your university will be defunded. And the same is true for all sorts of other big operations, whether the big corporations are the same. And so they're killing the small businesses in order to kill the economic security and independence that allows a certain level of freedom in the society.
Yeah, economic repression precedes political repression. It's someone once said, it's hard to get a man to understand a problem if his paycheck depends on him not understanding the problem. And it's very easy to get him to ignore the problem if the paycheck depends on him ignoring the problem. And that's what they're gradually doing. They're slowly grinding down. That's one of the effects of these extended lockdowns. I guess you could infer a partisan motivation. Blue states want to grind the economy down to hurt President Trump, but I think this goes far beyond that. It's so reckless and so destructive and so irrational at this point, given the science, even the science that they invoke all the time, that the only explanation would be that they are operating under maybe other commands. And some people, may perhaps they're working, people have done the research. They've made direct connections between a lot of the organizations or that the governors have relied upon for scientific advice, like out in Oregon, New York, or even the White House itself are organizations that are funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, not to mention the CDC and also the World Health Organization. And of course, now the Neil Ferguson at the London Imperial College, whose report or study became the justification for the lockdown. Now it's been reputed or discredited as bad modeling. And of course, he's a history of doing this, but he appears to fail upward. And if you look at all the pandemics that he's predicted and the modeling, which is predicted, Armageddon or just destruction, and they've always kind of never panned out or has been duds, is it's always resulted in greater concentration, whether it's British agriculture in Great Britain with the, I think it was the mad cow disease and the foot mouth disease, or with big pharma. And you can see how WHO has often been the WHO and also CDC have been a marketing extension of big pharma to purchase and distribute vaccines who otherwise wouldn't be taken or sold. And of course, Bill Gates is heavily invested in these things. He's also heavily invested in Impossible Burger meat or something. At the same time, now the crisis has become a pretext for shutting down meat processing plants. And now we have a surplus of animals not being slaughtered, but they can't be processed because the plants aren't operating fully under the guise of a so-called pandemic. And now you have a food crisis. And you have someone like Anthony Fauci who says we can't lift the lockdown for fear it will cost lives and hurt the recovery. I don't know. The reasoning behind that is there's no economic activity. How do you ever recover without economic activity? But he's just extending it and extending it and extending it. And he's not even taking into consideration the obvious question, which is the collateral damage, which you alluded to, is that if you shut down economic activity, you will literally within a year put more than a billion people at risk of starving to death. And there's a public health consequence for poverty, even disease. Many diseases, to the extent that they exist, are made much worse by conditions of poverty, like tuberculosis. It's a poverty disease. And people's ill health, anxiety, fear, that's going to lower immune system. And the fact that the very advice they're offering, stay inside, socially distance, they're depriving people the advantage of engaging their immune system. So throughout the summer months when they're out and about, their immune systems get stronger. So in the fall, when you have cold and flu season, they're in better position to fight these things off. The terrain is in better condition. But they're offering advice which is completely counter to what's normally understood to be good public health. That's what's so suspicious about it. And what's even suspicious about it is that when Anthony Fauci is testifying remotely, again, the theatrics behind that, everyone's wearing masks. It's all very theatrical now, is that no one bothers to ask him that question. Like, what about the billion that will starve to death within a year if you keep this going? You know, what about them? You know?
Yeah, right. And that's kind of strange because, again, as I said earlier, just like with Charlie Hebdo, in this case, people's good instincts, the kind of trusting and, you know, positive and compassionate nature of people is being abused and exploited. And we're told that you're protecting your grandmother, you're protecting the older people in the nursing homes, and you're protecting the vulnerable people by conforming to this lockdown and wearing the mask and so on and so forth. But what you're not told is that you may also be starving huge numbers of people all over the world. I think that if we engaged people's benevolence from the other side of the equation here, and you know, when especially because the people who are going along with this, again, are the sort of well-meaning, liberal, educated types who should be the first people to understand something like the global hunger problem. And so I think also we should, you know, keep in mind here that the medical model is interesting, that, you know, it seems like what they're saying about, you know, how to respond to this pandemic would conceivably make sense if the virus were a little bit more lethal. And perhaps it would also have to be a little bit sneakier in the sense of having a longer latency period and so on. They were originally estimating that it was 4 or 5% lethal, and then that went down to 1%. And now it's looking like it's probably closer to 0.1%, which is getting into the territory of ordinary flu. And it's got perhaps even a stronger bias towards people who have pre-existing problems, people with weakened immune systems and older people and so on. And so that, given that profile of this this virus, and of course we talk about the virus, what we're really talking about is the way this particular bug operates in a very, very complex microbiological ecosystem. That, you know, you can't really separate out just one factor, like one particular virus, and say that it causes directly this and that effect. It actually takes its place in a very complex ecosystem of you know, viruses and bacteria and so on. 10% plus of our bodies actually consists of microbial life. Mm-hmm. Our guts couldn't digest, you know, without that. And in any case, but to simplify matters and just kind of look at the way a virus, the effects a virus has when it, you know, gets into somebody and starts replicating. In this case, like in so many other cases, the fact that there is a supposedly terrible virus in you actually doesn't mean very much. We know that probably the majority of cases are asymptomatic. Many others are the equivalent of a very, very mild cold, a slight sore throat for a day, and then it's gone. Just like with other kinds of colds and even flus sometimes, some people's immune system seem to be able to push them off and others not so much. But when you have something like this that I believe was probably engineered to be a biological weapon, the sweet spot for engineering a biological weapon is it needs to be sufficiently lethal to cause serious problems for the enemy. You know, if people are just kind of getting mildly sick and nobody dies, then it's a pretty useless biological weapon. But it shouldn't, you know, just kind of kill everybody, because then they'll just totally quarantine it off. If it kills everybody very quickly, sort of like Ebola, they'll quarantine off the people who have it very quickly. And when the person gets it, they die, they don't transmit it to anybody else. And so the actual cost to the enemy of being hit with a virus like that is much, much lower than if they're hit with a virus that hits that sweet spot where, you know, it spreads a lot and it's somewhat lethal, but not super lethal, just lethal enough so that the whole society basically has to go on lockdown. The whole society has to expend vast amounts of resources dealing with it, or the enemy's military has to spend vast amounts of resources dealing with it, because tons of people are sick, a lot of them die, but not all of them. It takes a while for them to die, it takes a while for them to get sick, and so it actually creates a lot more of a weapon effect if it hits the sweet spot, which might be, you know, killing like maybe 2 or 3%, and making badly sick maybe, 50%, and then having that, 2 week or even better yet from the, it depends how fast you want to incapacitate the enemy, of course, if you're a biological weaponeer. But in any case, originally it looked like this thing was pretty much hitting that sweet spot where it's going to totally, paralyze the enemy's forces. And they're going to have to expend a lot of resources dealing with it and so on and so forth, because it was killing, more than 1% of the people that got it. But now that it looks like it isn't, they're still reacting as if it does. And that's kind of a puzzle. And, maybe it's worse than we realize, and they know something we don't know. That's always a possibility. If it's hard to tell. I mean, I do generally lean towards thinking that, you're right, that we should, we should be following the Swedish model, reopen, protect the vulnerable, lock down the nursing homes, pay people, triple wages, or whatever it takes to have the people who run the nursing homes live in the nursing homes and just lock them down and don't let anybody in and out as much as possible for 2 weeks or maybe a month. And then let it spread like wildfire among the kids, keep the schools open like Sweden did, and get your herd immunity quickly. That would be the rational way of dealing with it, presumably, according to what we know now about how lethal it is. But if it were worse, and it might be a little worse than we think, actually, the excess deaths count is much higher than the reported coronavirus deaths count. So rather than an exaggerated death count from this virus, we actually may be seeing an undercounted count if the mainstream statistics are true, and that's a big if, of course. But there are a lot of unknowns here. In any case, it's interesting that this initially took shape looking like a kind of a classic biological attack. It looked just like what you would expect for a biological attack on China, given that China had to totally lock down Wuhan right at the moment of the Chinese New Year. And its economy was paralyzed and so on and so forth. And, that was my first thought was, boy, this really ticks off the box of the China hawks, because, the China hawks know that if the Western bankster cabal that wants to rule the world is going to succeed, it's going to have to end China's double-digit economic growth. They desperately needed something to do that. They can't fight a military war against China. There's no real good recipe for that. I suppose they could get into some kind of limited war over the South China Sea or Taiwan or what have you, but those really don't look like winners for the West. So you would predict, 5 years ago, you would have predicted that around 2020, you would have a deniable biological attack on China, or maybe not deniable, but of course, if it's obviously targeting only Asian people or Chinese people, that's a little too obvious, and the Chinese are going to have to retaliate. So you'd want to make it deniable. One way to do that is to take down the whole world, lock down the whole world, and end the global economic engine that is the real source of China's double-digit growth. And you'd want to, bust up the interconnected globalized world that these same
they built.
Break it up now, because at this point, if it goes on any longer, China is going to be stronger than the Western bankster cabal. And that's the end of their dream of planetary dominance. And I think it's also important to point out that the bankster cabal knows that the only way that they have expanded their territory historically is through warfare and conquest. So when you talk about world government, what you're talking about is not the United Nations with teeth. It's not a voluntary association like the EU getting bigger and stronger. This is what all of the right-wing American libertarian types seem to be afraid of. But they're crazy. That's not going to be – you're never going to get a world government that way. The only way you'll ever get a world government, at least if we're paying attention to the lessons of history, is through global military conquest. There'll be a war of some kind. Maybe it'll be a Sun Tzu war where no shots have to be fired in anger. Nobody has to be killed. But one way or another, there's going to be a war, and the winner is going to control the world. And so who's that going to be? Well, the bankster cabal that wants the one world government under their control cannot allow China to keep growing a double-digit rate, or it's doomed. They'll never get their world government that way. So they're waging war on China, and it's an economic war, and I think the coronavirus is a huge part of that. They're also waging war on Main Street, and you know, I wrote an article for American Free Press pointing out that the war on the Chinese global Main Street, because China actually makes the real stuff that everybody uses, is also a war on American Main Street and Main Street everywhere else, because they're putting Main Street out of business in favor of Wall Street globally. And so this is all part of what Daniel Estulin says is part of this bankster cabal's move towards world government. But we have to point out that it's through military conquest as well as economic warfare of the kind that John Perkins talks about in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You know, he says that the economic warfare has actually eclipsed military warfare for these guys. But I think it's about 50-50, and I think the economic and military components are roughly in balance, and they are likely to ramp this up. So I think we should get ready for accelerated war on China and possible military flare-ups as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you'd look at this event chronologically, what was going on in the fall of 2019. I think Putin had made some remarks about the dollar losing its status as the de facto world reserve currency. And, of course, the growing trade deficit with China, which has been, I think, sharply reduced with this crisis. And also with the what happened to the repo markets, the interbank lending. And it was being bailed out, behind the scenes, hundreds of billions, if not trillions. And how do you continue doing that without sparking a run on the dollar? Well, you spark a crisis like this, and also the crisis actually will cause people at the very time the U.S. government, the Fed is inflating, with monetizing everything to bail the stock market out, Wall Street out, the banks out. You have people running in the U.S. treasuries because of what's going in China and in Europe with the lockdown. But I think it was Catherine Austin Fitz that suggested this might be it was an attempt to shore up the dollar with the eventual goal transitioning out of the dollar, not into an alternative currency, but into a social credit system, which they have kind of in China now anyway. So the China model, which was set up by the Rockefellers, the sort of the state capitalism technocratic control grid that was being praised by the World Health Organization, by many people, their ability to lock down so fast and these things, how this should be done in the West. You can't do that while holding to constitutional pretensions, a Bill of Rights and these things. So now you have a situation where the lockdown, the economic depression that it creates is blamed on the virus. And now in order to emerge from this, from the economic depression, the American people will have to submit or accept technocratic control measures like contact tracing, 24/7 monitoring with the cell phones, constant testing, biometric testing, monitoring, they'll call it voluntary vaccines, but you won't be able to engage in any commerce, any normal life without an immunity passport, is the term they used. And of course, these things are all contrary to our ideas of due process and civil liberties and freedom of movement and these things. But the crisis justifies, and you state the crisis itself, there doesn't seem to be much there, meaning that you have a disease. If it is a bioweapon, it turned out to be a dud. And I'm kind of an optimistic about this. And I think it's very hard to engineer viruses because viruses tend to mutate and you can't control them. And they tend to become more benign as they spread. But you have a disease that's 98 to 99% either asymptomatic or mild among the healthy population. And so they simply don't have the numbers to justify it. And that's why you saw the where they were borrowing. They were very general in their death certificates and seemed to be borrowing from other conditions to blame it on COVID-19. You get hit by a bus. You test positive COVID-19. They say you died of COVID-19, this sort of thing. And that doctors have been talking about the fraud that's been committed with death certificates to increase the numbers. You don't address the issue that a lot of the disease or illnesses that we see may not be one cause, because there's a lot of different causes for respiratory distress. Like in China, you have 300,000 people a year die of pneumonia, and that's because it's the bad air and the toxicity they're exposed to because of the rapid industry that's occurring there. Same conditions existed in Italy, I believe, northern Italy. And New York also has some air quality issues. But you also just have outright fraud that's occurring because of this agenda that's being pursued. And so again, you really can't get this transition. And they really want to do away with currency, perhaps, because currency itself, you know, as long as there's a dollar system as debauched as it is, they have to prop it up in order to engage in currency to maintain their control. Meanwhile, people who hold that currency have a certain degree of independence. But if you have a social credit system where you don't use money, and it's hard for people to imagine, that's really what they envision is a system with no money, social credit system, if you are troublesome. And you alluded to this earlier how when the economy has a lot of small, mid-sized local businesses with local patriotisms and interests and diverse interests, you yourself can organize a group that can be funded by these people to organize a meeting to get the word out, to challenge the official narrative. But with economic repression and your loss of the independence and the corporatization of the U.S. economy, where we all work for Amazon, where we all work for Walmart or a giant corporation, which is in a position to implement the very system, technocratic system you're talking about, under the guise of human resource policy or employment terms. And it all appears to be voluntary when it isn't, because they've destroyed alternatives. This is how our system that's very coercive can have a superficial appearance of voluntarism and freedom. But when you destroy all alternative means of employment, whether it's small farms or small businesses and this stuff, and you just blame it on a virus, go, oh, well, it happened. Nothing we can do about it. But you also have the strange relationship. You talk about the bioweapon, and it's very murky because it turns out that Anthony Fauci, the NIH, University of North Carolina, and Fred Dietrich, it appears they outsourced their bioweapon research to China.
Yeah, to Wuhan.
Yeah. Exactly.
Fauci paid like $6 or $7 million to the Wuhan lab to do this very dangerous gain of function research on bat coronaviruses.
Yes.
And then Fauci then becomes the coronavirus czar. It's a little too convenient. It's like Philip Zelikow being yes. The guy who predicted that in 1997, he and John Deutsch published that article in Foreign Affairs. Called something like the pivotal event or something like that this coming catastrophic terror attack. What would be the economic and social and historical effects of a massive terror attack on the United States, such as the destruction of the World Trade Center? So he predicts this in 1997, and then or 98, and then he becomes the czar of response. With Kissinger being the first choice until he was laughed out of there. Well, likewise, here's Fauci, the guy who actually set up that coronavirus germ warfare thing in Wuhan. How did he do that and why? Well, I would think it was a setup, sort of like the Saudis under control of Western agencies set up the fake, the alleged hijackers, patsies who were on the planes for 9/11. Likewise, Fauci and his friends, or whoever is behind them, set up the Wuhan lab. So, if there ever becomes any kind of controversy about this being a germ warfare weapon, they can blame China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think your overall the geopolitical, wrangling or game that's going on here is in order to weaken China, you have to decouple it from the global economy. How do you do that without creating mass disruption? Well, they created mass disruption. 35 million Americans unemployed overnight, and it's blamed on a virus as opposed to the geopolitical ambitions of the global elite or what some people, world planners, think is the right way to go. I mean, you couldn't justify that to the American people, but if you create a virus and blame it on China, and even you don't even have to provide much evidence, you just have to create sort of get it out there to a certain percentage of the American people will blame China the same way they blamed Afghanistan for 9/11 or Iraq for 9/11. Right? I mean, it's like you don't even have to say it, you just get it out there,
Yeah, that's true. It becomes kind of an unconscious emotional predisposition, the kind of hatred of the radical Muslims that was put out there with 9/11, I think escaped from the direct control of the people who manufactured that. And likewise with this, the anti-China animus is just out there. It's kind of free-floating. And, people do seek scapegoats. They want to blame somebody for their misfortunes. Mm-hmm. And the banksters who did this would much rather have you blame China than blame themselves.
Yeah, in the same way that, there'll be food shortages. And they'll say COVID-19 is causing food shortages. No, it's because there's restrictions on labor. People can't plant their farm. They don't have the labor for the farms. You have the processing plants that are shutting down, supposedly because of the virus. And if you get the public fearful enough about this, a good, you know, half's going to believe what everything the media tells them. And they're going to be putting on the masks. They're not going to want to emerge. They're not going to want to take risks. Think about the psychological effect of thinking you should avoid all risk in life, a safety first, that type of mantra, which is actually, if you think about it, is absurd. The moment you walk out the door, you're taking more risk. But the risk of not going out is greater because we're seeing, even with the spike, like in UK, they had a spike in deaths, and they're saying it's because of the isolation brought about because of the lockdown, not because of the virus or any disease, it's because of the health effects of these things. And the long-term psychological effect of a society, I saw a video talking about how there was a school in Quebec planning to reopen, and the measures that they have planned for these kids, I mean, it's psychological terror, where the kids don't get within 6 feet of one another. Recess, they can't get close to one another. Where they walk is they have to follow a path. They can't leave their desk except to go to the bathroom all day. And when they go to the bathroom, they're monitored. And the bathroom has to be cleaned afterwards. This sort of germophobia, they've weaponized the germ theory, made everyone sort of obsessive compulsive on these things. They've created mass hysteria. Do you think about it? Much of the... There's a lot of research with Western intelligence agencies and think tanks, and they go into sort of weaponizing mass hysteria. That's what the Tavistock Institute and really what the Rand Corporation look into. Sort of, how do you weaponize mass hysteria or mass psychosis? And you study the psychology of the individual. You know, this grew out of World War One, and the effect of a shell shock on people, and supposedly it was done to help cure, but really it was weaponized. And what we see in the 20th century is one shock after another, like Naomi Klein calls it, the shock doctrine. How you create fear, hysteria, crises, and exploit the crisis. Never let a crisis go to waste. And we see in all the events, that's where your articles were so good, but you draw in each of these instances, it's a crisis that's either contrived, misrepresented to the public, and then exploited by various interests to expand their wealth and also further enslave the public. You know, like scanners. A good example was that Rapiscan scandal with Michael Chertoff a few years ago. And people forget about this, but the underwear bomber, it's admitted that the U.S. government put that guy on the plane as an exercise. And then when he tried to detonate his bomb, it didn't go off, wasn't designed to. This created the pretext to roll out the scanners in the airports, millions of which have already been manufactured. And Michael Chertoff, whose organization, he spoke on its behalf either before Congress or even he did media appearances talking about how we need this for security, where it turns out his own group, his PR firm, was representing Rapiscan, the company that was making it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the weaponization of mass hysteria that you're talking about partly grew out of the work of Edward Bernays, Freud's nephew, who figured out that Freud's discovery of the unconscious could be put to work in manipulating people by in mass. And so that discovery that really kicked in the 1920s has led to all of these kinds of manipulations of people's unconscious minds. And we are seeing that now, this mass hysteria. It may continue to go on. I don't know. I mean, where will this all go? I'm wondering if it turns out that it becomes obvious enough that these draconian measures were ill-advised, and if the the so-called pandemic gradually decreases and things are looking a lot more normal by the fall, actually, Trump could benefit from this.
Yeah.
It could backfire a little bit, at least, you know, in terms of the domestic political implications. But whether it backfires all the way, you know, what I would like to see is people waking up and figuring out what's really going on, and then, you know, rising up with torches and pitchforks and basically burning down the entire bankster establishment. I don't know if I'll live long enough to see that, but, you know, inshallah.
Well, that's the thing, is you're seeing sort of the system, the internal contradictions of the system we live under. And it constantly has to be barreled out. You have these continuous busts and, you know, periodic busts, and, you know, and and what they learned to cover them up with a crisis, whether it's 2001, you know, or in this with the coronavirus, you had a bust, the stock market bust, and another bailout that coincides with, you know, a pandemic. You know, so this is why it's necessary. But yeah, you'd like to see some sort of wider recognition or consciousness of the injustice and the inefficiency and injustice of the system that we live under, which is the usurious, you know, fractional reserve banking system that was constructed, you know, a century ago to bring about the very enslavement that they're trying to impose on us today. That's perhaps the silver lining in this event, is that I think it was a leap forward that has woken up a lot more people to this, to the reality of the situation. Otherwise, they, you know, under sort of a generalized continual prosperity, they can boil the frog, and now people are, you know, the wolf is at the door. You got to acknowledge it. What are you going to do? They're not letting you go outside, or not letting you go to work, and they're telling you just to wait, and then accept government bailout checks. But you know, recently the House just passed a $3 trillion relief bill. Where are they getting this money? Where they're printing it? And there's a, you know, at some point, not going to matter how fat a check the government sends you if people aren't going to work, right? I mean, things have to be produced. Trucks have to be.
Well, they're all produced in China these days.
But, yeah,
you know, that's not going to happen anymore either if they cut off China. Trump just threatened to completely cut all U.S. Relationships, including trade relationships with China. So guess what? All the stores are going to be empty.
Yes, that's the result. But this is the very system they constructed back in the 1970s with the Trilateral Commission. David Rockefeller talked about what a great guy Mao was, because Mao was necessary to traumatize Chinese so they could be set up to be the workhouse or factory of the world in the 80s, 90s. And the aughts, and that's what they've done. And you know, in the 70s and 80s, there was a decision made to deindustrialize the West and shift the geographical productions around the world, so you could leverage humanity against one another, use cheap labor, and you have all these various, you know, whether it's South America or Asia, that have been subjected to periodic civil wars and regime change operations. And you know, but we saw it in the 50s with the CIA, in Guatemala or Iran, or even, you know, China or Asia or Vietnam. I mean, even Vietnam is now, you know, is a member of the IMF now. So much for communist revolution. But the idea that you could leverage humanity and equalize the wages of the world, so you could tap the cheap labor of some of these countries and sort of leverage it against the industrialized labor of the West.
Yeah, drive labor rates down everywhere.
Yeah. And at the same time, this is where the economic hitman model is important, because that's a certain phase where you're keeping these countries poor and destabilized, you know, in many cases forcing them off agricultural land that they've been on for many centuries. And so that land can be bought up on the cheap by oil companies. Then you have a surplus labor in the urban centers that the factories can come in, and now you can have them make your Nike shoes and your baseball gloves at a much lower cost, or your clother, you know, your clothing, but people have a hard time seeing the wider picture, how decades ago these things were carried out so you could exploit their cheap labor in the future and then use it to deindustrialize the West and impoverish, you know, people in Europe and the United States, which they've kind of done with the debt based model. You know, wages have stagnated, but credit has expanded and debt has gone up. And that's where you get that system what you talk about. It's a debt-based system where it's compound interest. You're grinding everyone down over the years. So.
Yep. Well, we pretty much hit the end of the hour. One thing we didn't talk about, though, was the censorship epidemic. And I think it's interesting that, you know, post 9/11, the Achilles heel of the people that did it was the internet. That is, they didn't realize that the internet was just coming into flower at that point, and that 9/11 would be the event the internet was created for, because it sponsored the rise of the 9/11 truth movement. Mm-hmm. At that time, they still believed in, you know, at least gave lip service to free speech and the Constitution. So in preparation for this one, starting in 2016, they started ramping up internet censorship, and now it's reached draconian proportions, where, you know, David Icke is totally taken down from all of the big platforms, and all kinds of, you know, basically anything that goes against the CDC guidelines in any way, shape, or form is subject to deplatforming. So there's massive internet censorship going on now, and I think that's a clue as to, you know, who's behind this and what they're trying to stop here, which is people waking up.
And that's pretty obvious. I mean, that's what they did was past couple of years is so audacious that, you know, it shocked a lot of people. But it also shocked me how many Americans simply didn't really think much of the First Amendment. if they happened to disagree with the person being 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 censored. Something else. I think it was Frank Zappa, interesting guy, background and his connections. But he said the illusion of freedom will be maintained as long as it's profitable.
Yeah. I just put that up as my False Flag Weekly News image of the week last week, I think it was.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think we hit the end of the hour. I'm expecting a phone call, so
I will let you go. Listen, thank you so much, Dr. Barrett.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Timothy. It's always great talking with you.
Get outside. Good work. Get some sun. Enjoy that spring weather.
I'm going to get outside and get some rain today.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you need that. For, you know, every day rain must, you know, need rain. So
yeah, rain's good for you too.
Yes. Okay, thanks so much. I'll let you go and enjoy your Sunday. Bye bye.
Yep, you too. Bye.
Early one morning the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she changed at all, if her hair was still red. Her folks and our lives together, sure was it gonna be rough. Never liked mama's homemade dress, papa banquet wasn't big enough. For me, I'm standing on the side of the road with the rain falling in my shoes. Heading out to the East Coast, Lord knows I pay some dues getting through. Tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. Kept her out of a jam, I guess, but it used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could and abandoned it out west. Splitting up on the docks at night, both agreeing it was for the best. She turned around and looked at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue. Tangled up in blue. I took a job in the Great North Woods, working as a cook for a spell. Never liked it all that much, till one day the axe just fell. I drifted down to New Orleans, where my luck was to be employed. Working out on a fishing boat outside of Delacroix. All the while I was alone, the passing close behind. I met a lot of women there, but you never escaped my mind. She just blew, tangled up in blue. Hang it up, place, and I stopped in for a beer. Kept staring at the side of her face and the spotlight so clear. Later on when the crowd thinned down, I was just about to do the same. Saw her standing there behind my chest, said to me, don't I know your name. I muttered something underneath my breath. She studied the lines of my face. Must admit I felt a little uneasy when she bent out the tight lace of my shoe. I was tangled up in blue. She lit a burner on the stove. She offered me a pipe. Said, I thought you'd never say hello. You know you look like the silent type. She opened up a book of poems. She handed it to me. Written by an Italian poet from the 13th century. Every one of those words rang true and they flowed like a glowing coal. Born of every page like they was written in my soul for me to you. Tangled up in blue. lived with them on Montague Street in the basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafe, revolution in the air. He started in the dealing with slaves, something inside of him died. Had to sell everything he owned, and he froze up inside. Finally, when the bottom fell out and I became withdrawn, the only thing left to do was keep on keeping on like a bird that flew. Tangled up in blue. Now I'm going back again, gotta get to her somehow. Everybody that we used to know, there's illusions to me now. Some are mathematicians, some are carpenters' wives. And how the whole thing got started, don't know what they're doing with their lives. Me, I'm still out on the road, looking for another joint. We always had the same idea, we just saw it from a different point of view.